When Reed was resurrected from political oblivion in 1977 by Governor Mike O'Callaghan to become the head of the Gaming Commission, there was still mob influence in the casino industry. And people probably have seen some of the movies, including Casino, about the casino industry back then. In fact, Reed is a character in that movie, played by Tommy Smothers, which for those of us who are old enough to remember is kind of funny and kind of apt. For how Reed was. But he O'Callaghan appointed him because he needed someone he trusted intimately, and he needed somebody who he knew was tough. And he knew Reed was tough. And Reed was very tough as the head of the Gaming Commission. But some of the decisions he made were seen as favorable to mob-influenced people. And so he became investigated by the FBI himself, and that lasted for some time before he was finally cleared all the way into his time in Congress.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of Eastern Iowa and Northwestern Illinois. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and today is the second week of our examination of two of the giants of the United States Senate, the two most consequential senators this century. Last week, it was Kentucky Senator Mitch McConnell, through the eyes of Michael Tackett, author of the book about McConnell called The Price of Power. This week, our focus is on Nevada Democrat Harry Reid. My guest today is John Ralston, who wrote a book about Reid that just came out. It's called The Game Changer, How Harry Reid Remade the Rules and Showed Democrats How to Fight. Many of you may recognize John. He is a regular guest on, I was going to say MSNBC, but it's MSNOW now, and Meet the Press on NBC. I followed his work for years. And just nobody better or an expert on Nevada politics than John. He's the founder and CEO of the Nevada Independent. He's done this for 30 years. He's the authority on this topic, and there's nobody better, quite frankly, to write a book about Harry Reid. And I'm really honored to have you as a guest today. Thank you, John.
Thanks for having me, Robin.
Well, it sure has been interesting to read about these two famous senators. A lot of similarities, but some key differences. And I guess we'll start right off, I guess, in your subtitle, How to Fight. This guy was brought up in really tough circumstances, and I think it plays a role in how he, in shaping his career. If you could start there and talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. He grew up in a place called Searchlight, which is barely a speck on the map of Nevada. And had about 200 people in it when he was born. No services of any kind. Just he grew up in a shack, literally, and so it was unimaginable poverty. And he developed a love-hate relationship with Searchlight. He loved what it represented to him, but he hated living there, and he wanted to, as he so Harry Reid like put it to me, get the hell out of Searchlight. And so he did. But I think that fighting spirit. And it was really forged in him in Searchlight, and then to some extent in Henderson, which was a small town, but it seemed huge to him at the time when he went to high school there, and made some of the key connections of his life, including his wife and political mentor, Mike O'Callaghan, who was a teacher and later governor. So I really do think that his fighting spirit that you alluded to began in Searchlight, which he was fighting to emulate in terms of the grittiness, but fighting to get away from because of what it represented.
You know, he exhibited a lot of characteristics that Mitch McConnell did, too, that I noted. But how did Harry Reid decide to take a path into politics? I mean, everybody you read about in history, they seem to come about this in different ways, it seems like, and especially from his circumstances. It seemed like he could have gone into several different areas. But why did he pick politics?
You know, it's a great question. And actually, it's one I haven't been asked very often, so I'm glad you did ask it. And Most people in Nevada think of Harry Reid, who know anything about him, as this incredibly calculating, strategic guy, which he was when he became a U.S. Senator and then in leadership. But he fell into politics almost by accident when, as a young guy, he was asked to run for the hospital board, the county hospital board, and he jumped at the chance for a variety of reasons. He had represented insurance companies and he had some beefs with some doctors, so he was eager to try his hand at it. And then he did so well and had such a natural aptitude for it that he was asked to run for the state legislature, and then he became lieutenant governor and ran a few times unsuccessfully after that, including for the Senate, and then an embarrassing run for Las Vegas mayor before Michael Callahan, who I mentioned earlier, resurrected him and made him the head of the gaming commission, which led to a became the springboard from running for Congress in 1982 in a new seat. And the rest, as they say, Robin, is history.
Yeah, well, that's you just gave that sweeping view of what happened. I want to go back because one of the things for our listeners out there, one of the things about this book that I enjoyed, it's obviously a great work about Harry Reid, but this is almost history of the casino industry. And there's so many elements to this that are interesting. We could talk about this for a couple of hours probably, but try to set that up. I mean, that's in most states. I mean, tobacco was big in Kentucky, and corn and soybeans here in Illinois. But I think to have listeners understand this story, if you could give a little background on the casino industry and then Reed's role coming into that and why that was so important.
I'm so glad you brought that up because I did hope that the book would show that Reed's evolution and how he conducted himself kind of mirrored the growth of the state, the evolution of Nevada, both economically, politically, and to some extent culturally as well. When Reed was resurrected from political oblivion in 1977 by Governor Michael Callahan to become the head of the Gaming Commission, there was still mob influence in the casino industry. And people probably have seen some of the movies, including Casino, about the casino industry back then. In fact, Reed is a character in that movie, played by Tommy Smothers, which for those of us who are old enough to remember is kind of funny and kind of apt, but for how Reed was. But O'Callaghan appointed him because he needed someone he trusted intimately, and he needed somebody who he knew was tough. And he knew Reed was tough. And Reed was very tough as the head of the Gaming Commission. But some of the decisions he made were seen as favorable to mob influenced people. And so he became investigated by the FBI himself, and that lasted for some time before he was finally cleared, all the way into his time in Congress in the early 1980s. But it was a very different state then. He had a famous confrontation with a guy named Lefty Rosenthal, who was one of the mob's guys in Las Vegas. And there's famous video of that, and it's dramatized in the movie Casino. Lefty Rosenthal is a character played by Robert De Niro in that movie, for those who have seen it. And so he was very, very tough. That was a harrowing time for him in many ways. Excuse me, he told me Lefty Rosenthal was the only person he was ever afraid of in his life, because Rosie, not because he thought Rosenthal would do anything to him, but that he would hire somebody to do something to him. But Reed survived all that, survived the FBI investigation, and I think probably became tougher because of it, and more skeptical of federal law enforcement because of it.
Well, there was even a story in your book where there was a scare of something found in his wife's car.
There was a very crudely made bomb that was found in his wife's car. It was terrifying to both of them, obviously. It did not go off. A similar type device was placed in another member of the Gaming Commission's car, but Reed and Landra Reed, who is his wife of 62 years, and that's an amazing love story that I only get a, only touch on in the book, but hopefully paint the contours of how important she was in his life. That was a searing experience for them, and seeing their 5-year-old kid at the time peering out the window at all of the law enforcement vehicles outside. And even back then, 40 plus years ago, Robin, they were given remote devices to start their cars from the rest of the time that they were in Vegas.
You mentioned Tommy Smothers, and those of us of a certain age will remember. And I was thinking about this too, about the individual I'm going to talk about here. But only people of a certain age will recognize the name and the significance of this. But I was fascinated when Howard Hughes' name pops up in this book and the very real relationship that Reed had with him. Talk about that a little bit, if you would.
Yeah, that was one of the great revelations that I found that I knew nothing about. I knew a lot about Reed before I started this book, but there were a lot of things I found in his archive at the University of Nevada, Reno, that I didn't know anything about. And one of those things was his assignment from Mike O'Callaghan, the governor, when he was lieutenant governor, which essentially is a sinecure. The lieutenant governor doesn't do anything except preside over the state senate, which is only in session here 4 months out of every 24. So he had plenty of free time to do this assignment, which O'Callaghan wanted you to make sure Hughes could actually still oversee his casino empire. He had evaded coming before gaming authorities during the tenure of Paul Laxalt, the previous governor. So he assigned Reed to go find out what the real situation was with Hughes. And so what Reed did is he went and all over the place in Nevada, California, and Utah, if I remember correctly, to visit with these Hughes intimates and interview them about Hughes and whether he was of sound mind and body. And Reed, who was known throughout his career to keep meticulous notes on yellow legal pads, whether he was in college or later in his elected life, made extensive notes that were in the archive that I got to piece together, and it became an entire chapter I didn't think was going to be part of the book. And he eventually got a picture for O'Callaghan, and a meeting was eventually set up between O'Callaghan and Hughes in London, and that Reed helped facilitate. And O'Callaghan came back from the meeting and told Reed some things about Hughes, which Reed also memorialized, and I put into the book. And so that was just a fascinating part of Reed's history that I knew nothing about.
We'll add too, and my listeners are probably going, come on, let's get into the political stuff. But this is just too interesting too, because I love the history of the area. But there's also mention here of Frank Sinatra and Wayne Newton. We won't get into that. You'll have to go get the book to read that. But those were other two people that pop up in this book. And again, it's a political story, but it's also a history of the Las Vegas area, entertainment, the mob. There's a lot to this book that I think you'll really enjoy. Okay, let's get back to politics. He's elected in 1982 to Congress. Nevada is changing, starting to change rapidly. But let's move ahead in 86. He had an opening to run for the U.S. Senate. Talk a little bit about that campaign. I mean, I remember campaigns back in that era, but I mean, it is different. But for our listeners, talk a little bit about what he did, how he won, how the tactics might have been a little different than now.
Well, he actually got a glimpse of the kind of smash mouth tactics that Reed would become known for in his career in that race against a guy named Jim Santini, who was a longtime congressman, Democratic congressman, who was persuaded by Laxalt and others to switch parties just in time to run for Laxalt's seat. He was retiring. That was the first race I covered as a political reporter
Oh.
here in Nevada, and I was thrown into it a month before the primary, and I knew nothing about Nevada politics at the time, or next to nothing. And as I've told others, and I'll tell you, I went to meet Harry Reid, who was a congressman at the time, as you pointed out, and I knew nothing about him as well. And I came out of that meeting thinking, in my great amateur punditry back then, this guy has no chance to win this race. He had no charisma. He had the weakest handshake of anyone I had ever met, was barely articulate, and yet that belied a ruthlessness and a cutthroat approach in which his team had sent an information to a reporter. So when Santini announced, and they knew Santini had a sweating problem, would begin to profusely sweat, and they had video of that that they used in an amazing set of ads, some of the best ads I've ever seen in all the years I've covered politics, 40 years worth, where they showed him sweating and showed which Jim Santini do you believe, the one who was a Democrat or the one who was a Republican. Absolutely devastating. And so that race was just a great baptism of fire for me to understand politics. And Ronald Reagan, who was president at the time and Laxalt's best friend, came to the state multiple times to try to save Santini, but Reed still won.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and I'm very, very honored, pleased today to have as my guest John Ralston. Many of you may know him from being on TV, Meet the Press, MSNOW. I still want to call it MSNBC. He is the foremost expert on Nevada politics, and he has been for many, many years. And he's written a book called The Game Changer: How Harry Reid Remade the Rules and Showed Democrats How to Fight. Again, this is bookend after an interview last week about Mitch McConnell, the Kentucky Republican. And again, these are the two, I think, if you voted a vote among historians, journalists, these are the two most consequential U.S. senators this century, no doubt about it. We've talked a little bit about gaming Harry Reid's rise, and he just got elected to the U.S. Senate in 1986. He's had these FBI investigations. I thought one interesting thing is some of his issues, stances that he started with. He was what you would call kind of a conservative Democrat back when he was elected. Kind of go through briefly some of his stances on issues and how, especially, he was able to balance. And you articulate very well, he was a prime defender of Nevada's two top industries, gambling and mining. How he kind of had to balance that environmentalism of the Democratic Party with promoting the mining interests of the state.
He threaded a lot of needles that I think very few politicians could have, and you are outlined it very, very well there. He was a conservative Democrat when he was elected first to Congress and then to the Senate. In fact, his first campaign for the Senate was independent, like Nevada. He and we were a slightly Republican state at the time, but turning purple a little bit, and Reid saw that, and people around him saw that. But remember, this is a guy who was pro-life. He was a Mormon, a pro-life Democrat, and so that was certainly an issue for him to deal with in that caucus, and became even more of one later on as more women got elected to the U.S. Senate. But also, he was a restrictionist on immigration. He said things back then, as I've said many times since the book came out, that sounded like Ted Cruz or Donald Trump today. He was very much against birthright citizenship. He kept talking about how undocumented immigrants were taking Americans' jobs. And then, as you know, he changed that position either out of principle, out of personal contact with people, or because the state's Hispanic population was growing and became a significant part of the electorate that benefited him and many other Democrats, including Democrats running for president, who, when Nevada became a player in presidential politics, needed to win this state. And as you mentioned, he was an environmentalist, but he was stood up for mining as nobody ever has. And how he managed to accomplish that, again, I found so much great information about that in my research that I devoted an entire chapter to how he did that. But he did it. And he protected the mining industry, but he also, I think, outside of perhaps passing Obamacare, which he was almost singularly responsible for, Robin, he was proudest of his environmental legacy, protecting wilderness lands, setting up national monuments. There was a Harry Reid Environmental Center named for him because of that. And so, listen, I try not to, as I did this, and I think no biographer should look into his soul to try to figure out exactly why he did things and let the actions speak for themselves. But out of a combination of principle and personal influences, be it Landrieu or others, and pragmatism, he changed on significantly on some issues through his tenure.
He takes a dual track here as his career rises after getting elected to the Senate. And we'll go through this in our remaining time. We got about 10 minutes here. On the governmental side, what did he do to kind of prepare himself to be leader? You just don't get you just don't get in and you didn't get elected to that. And this where it's very similar to Mitch McConnell. What kind of what did he kind of master there to try to build that into a position of leadership later?
It's another great question, Robin. Another, I think, misunderstanding about Reid is that he wanted to be the Democratic leader from the moment he stepped foot in the Senate. I don't think that's true at all. But I also don't think he understood the dynamics of what a disadvantage a small state has in D.C. on Capitol Hill. But his election essentially coincided with Congress deciding to change the law to stick Nevada with the nuclear high-level nuclear waste dump, which passed what he called and others called the Screw Nevada Bill, which narrowed the sites from three to just one. So there was only one place they could put it. And that occurred in 1987 in his first year in the Senate. And I think he realized that the only way that he was ever going to stop that or actually do a lot for Nevada was to make his way into leadership. And he needed a lot of things to happen. One thing that I won't delve too deeply into here was Tom Daschle being elected as well, and with kind of being his mentor and elevating him. But when Reid became whip after the 1998 election, thanks to Daschle, and Reid barely won in 1998, but he became whip. And he did something in that job that no one has ever done, and that Daschle, in an interview he did with me, told me a lot about. And Reid and Dick Durbin, who succeeded him, told me a lot about, is he got to the floor first thing in the morning, and he stayed all day long and developed relationships along with his staff that would pay off a lot for him as he ascended the ladder. And he got quid pro quos, either stated or tacitly with other senators that helped him win leadership votes and hold that caucus together. One of his staffers described him as a human pinball machine on the Senate floor, just going back and forth. And he did favors for senators. They didn't want to be there going through all the grunt work of having to speak about amendments. So he did that for them. And that paid off for him. And no whip before or afterwards had done that. In fact, in a very funny comment, when Durbin was handpicked by Reid to succeed him as whip, Reid told him, you have to be there all day and all night, Dick, to do this job right. And Durbin essentially said, I'm not going to do that. Are you crazy? And so, but Daschle was so appreciative that he didn't have to pay attention to that stuff and could just get reports from Reid. But without that kind of work ethic and that strategic vision, which are the two things that made him successful, he never would have become leader.
The other thing that was progressing was politically. Nevada as a state is undergoing enormous demographic changes at this time. And also another good thing about this book that political lovers will enjoy is how campaigns changed. And he had several key campaigns there in the late 90s and early 2000s where his whole operation was kind of overhauled to take advantage of that. And I did know, as with McConnell, that women played a big role in his governmental and political side. But anyway, talk about how they adapted to the political changes there.
As I said, Reid almost lost in 1998 to a congressman by the name of John Ensign, who came in the Gingrich Revolution of 1994. And Ensign was everything Reid was not. He was charismatic. He was articulate. He was a formidable candidate that Reid did not take seriously and actually had open disdain for. He couldn't believe that this two-term congressman was running against him. But Ensign almost beat him, and Reid believed that he should have lost that race and told me so afterwards. And he said, I need to overhaul everything, my campaign team, and the Democratic Party, which he did, including firing his best friend from high school, who was his chief of staff, which I could tell even from the interview I did with Reid about that was still a painful memory for him that many years later. And so he brought in a woman from Missouri by the name of Rebecca Lamb, who was a field expert, and she helped him overhaul the Democratic Party. And they made it into a formidable machine, which I called the Reid Machine, a name that stuck and helped not only him win, but presidential candidates win and down ticket races. And they essentially dominated Nevada politics from the late 2000s and through 2024, when not coincidentally, I think the first presidential cycle after Reid's death, it went back to the Republicans. But the machine is still there. Rebecca Lamb is still there. But it's not quite the same without the guy who started it.
Yeah. In the time left, I've got several things, but we're not going to be able to get them all in. But I got to talk about the filibuster and Reid's controversial role in changing the rules of the filibuster. There's interesting, a lot of blame to go around. McConnell's take in talking to Tackett was very interesting, but kind of set this up for us in a couple minutes, if you can, just what his, how his views evolved on the filibuster and why he came to take the action that he did.
And if I might, Robin, after I do this real quickly, I want to say a word about McConnell and Reid, if I could.
Sure, go right ahead. So
real quickly, Reid was against doing anything with the filibuster. He was on record opposing it until he was on record wanting to get rid of it in 2013, when he thought that Obama's presidency was at risk and that none of his judicial nominees were getting approved and agencies such as the National Labor Relations Board couldn't get their appointees approved. So he decided to take the very dramatic and unprecedented step. And this was huge for a guy who had become a Senate institutionalist already by then, believing in the rules, et cetera. And he was on record many times that I detail in the book saying you can't change the filibuster or the Senate will become the House. But he did. And it took him a long time to get the Democrats on board. Some of them were a little bit recalcitrant about this, but he did it. And as you know, Republicans and McConnell used that as a precedent later on to get three Supreme Court justices approved when McConnell changed that. Now, it's interesting because I do think that McConnell would have done it either way, but to have the rhetorical leverage that Reid had provided. And I think the two were very, listen, one of the great regrets I have is that McConnell would not do an interview for the book. And I tried very hard. And his staff, I think, advocated for me because they said I had a reputation and I would be fair. But I think McConnell didn't want to be put in the position of saying anything negative about Reid after he passed away, because Reid passed away 6 months after I started researching this book, which was too bad. But they were very similar, as one of his staffers said to me. They were both killers. And there was no doubt in some people's minds that Reid, if the positions were reversed, that Reid would have done what McConnell did. And I have no doubt of that either, Robin. They were very, very similar. Reid initially really liked McConnell, but said he was very cold to him when he became his rival and wouldn't meet with him. And so I don't think their relationship ended on a very cordial note.
Very, very fascinating. I'm glad you talked a little bit about the Reid and McConnell relationship, because that's critical. That's an important part of nation's history, and some strong similarities in these two individuals. Neither really aspired to be president at all, which most U.S. senators, as the thing goes, look in the mirror and see a president. But they did take the route to power, some similar ways, some different. So just a fascinating look at two very people of this century. And John, again, I thank you so much for taking the time to be with me today to talk about this book. I recommend it to our listeners, The Game Changer, How Harry Reid Remade the Rules and Showed Democrats How to Fight. Great book. Thank you so much.
Robin, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. You can follow Heartland Politics at WVIK.org or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.